Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody is doing well. Good God, I hope you got your taxes in. I know, we're going to start off deep, hip deep, if you didn't get your taxes done, folks. I know that there's the Doge and everything else going on, but make no mistake, the one thing that is always certain is taxes will catch you. So make sure you got those in. I hope everybody is doing well. Hope everybody is having a great Tuesday night. I got to tune into the Side Chick show for a little while tonight. They had Pat O'Connell on. She's great. She's got an awesome story. We've had her on the show at Texas UFO Con, things like that. I hope those guys are doing well. It seemed like it was a good live stream for them tonight. We've got a great stream for you tonight. In the second part, after a commercial break, we will be talking with our good friend Jared Murphy, as well as Christy Bass from ArchaeoX. We'll be talking with them about the complex that they are busy uncovering in Belize, how you can get involved with that personally, how you can actively like go help dig, sift, look for ancient ruins, things like that. It's an incredible opportunity. We'll be talking about that in the second part. In the first part, we will be joined by our good friend Ryan Edwards to discuss the direwolf and the pseudo-resurrection of said species. I say pseudo-resurrection because, well, is it an actual resurrection? You know, and that's the question. Welcome back, Ryan. How are you doing this evening, my friend?
Hey, Chris, it's good to be here.
Always great to chat with you. And, you know, as soon as this story dropped, you contacted me and was like, hey, you want to talk about this? And I was like, yes, I do. Because there have been numerous, almost ready-made announcements like this lately, where it's like they are ready with the whole rollout immediately. And I mean, don't get me wrong, they're a biosciences company, folks. Colossal Biosciences is who actively has done this project, things like that. But it's a big step to say we have de-extincted a species, you know, and I think what a lot of people get confused here, Ryan, is that, and I had a conversation with my wife tonight about it, and she was like, so what, it's not like they had actual access to DNA, and I was like, oh no, they did, they have woolly mammoth DNA, they're the ones that made the woolly mammoth mouse a few months ago. They have access to dodo. They have access to thylacine DNA. So there are a few species that they have been working on. Romulus, Remus, and Khaleesi are the three pups that have come out of this. And the difference is this is not like a Dolly. Like you were probably a little young whenever Dolly the sheep hit the newsstands, but that was the first real full push of this is an actual clone of something.
Yeah, exact.
An exact clone of a species. And that is not what we have here with the direwolf, unfortunately. No. It's not a direct clone or anything like that. And I think the main thing to understand is that the dire wolf in and of itself was a separate species.
Yeah, no, like, it's interesting. One of the reasons I wanted to connect with you and talk about this is because the amount of, I guess, miseducation and not exactly misinformation, but just misconceptions.
Yeah.
You know, a lot with this. Like, for instance, it was only back in 2021 that we learned that what we call a dire wolf, what was once Canis diris, is actually not a wolf at all. It's a species of canine that separated from gray wolves about 6 million years ago. It's a totally different lineage. It convergently evolved alongside gray wolves, but they actually evolved here in North America. Yeah. Canis lupus evolved somewhere else and then moved into around Pleistocene North America. Like, I'll give people this, 6 million years might not seem that far, but think about it. Chimpanzees and humans diverged probably around 5 million years ago. So these animals are no way related. For instance, another species of modern canine that's about separated around the same time as from Anacyrondyrus are jackals. Like, jackals are about as more, possibly even more closely related to dire wolves than the gray wolf. Like, for instance, when people think dire wolf, they probably think of the wolves from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Giant white wolf, which truly, from a paleontological record, are not what dire wolves look like. These are not what we are expecting when we see when we say dire wolf.
Yeah, yeah, and you know the really what it comes down to is a lot of the idea of genetic editing, like There have been a few folks from institutes, things like that, that have been like, these are much more like designer dogs, where you have decided that, like, I would like a husky with a thicker coat and bluer eyes, you know, things like that. Kind of like the same way that you can pseudo design your children, so to speak, where it's like you can. And this is where technology like CRISPR and things like that comes in, where instead of. Let's say what was done famously, the easiest thing to analogize this to would be Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Where that wasn't gene editing, that was full on cloning. And the once again, Dolly the sheep, we have not had successful efforts with cloning. Let's just say, but most clones have had a very limited lifespan. They have not had a good lifespan. They have not had a healthy lifespan. But genetic editing provides us with a different background, and that's very much what this is, where basically, yes, they had access to the genetic material of direwolf and mapped it and found the genes that through an analog, because once again, it's not like they've taken a direwolf, they've taken a gray wolf, which is a totally different species. Adapted that through genetic editing.
Yeah, like one thing I tell people with the whole dire wolf phenomena right now is these are not de-extincted dire wolves. These are pretty much synthetic species. These are gray wolves that have been morphologically or behaviorally adapted to look like what we think dire wolves would look like.
Yeah.
And that's even an issue right there, because with dire wolves not being related to gray wolves, when we look at these dire wolves that we made, Rhombus and Remus and Khaleesi, they're giant white wolves, pretty much. Giant white gray wolves. And in my honest opinion, while looking at like actual phenotypic genotypes of dire wolves, they probably would have looked more like modern-day dole or jackal. They probably would have had black fur or red fur and not these giant white wolves that we see now.
Go ahead.
But what we think about is also like how like society affects dire wolves too. A lot of people, when they think dire wolf, they think giant white wolf, and that's exactly what Colossal is made.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And granted, they have numerous efforts. They are part of the Red Wolf Repopulation Program, which is amazing. You know, they've done some really great work in actively helping rebreed and repopulate that. And you know, that brings to mind a lot of questions when you because there is that concept of I guess the whole caveat of Jeff Goldblum's character. You know, you didn't stop to think if you should.
Yeah.
You know, you found out that you could, and you never stopped to think if you should. And there is that ethical question there of, well, you know, and granted, something like the thylacine is a great example, and even the dodo is a great example of humanity's impact on a species. The other species that they're working with, woolly mammoth, things like that, those were gone long, long ago. We hunted woolly mammoth, but it's not like we hunted them to extinction.
This brings out and also another issue, I think, just with education in general, is like the what we think of extinction is very different from what it actually is. Like, extinction, we think, an animal dies out because a human dies out because of this. Well, extinction doesn't really work like that. Extinction is more of a ecology going disappearing. Like, I'll bring this up with the dire wolf. We bring up like dire wolf, and like people brought up like introducing this new species into the wilderness. That wouldn't work out. The ecosystem that dire wolves lived in no longer exists. The megafaunal species they co-evolved alongside, giant ground sloths, mastodons, mammoths, equids, camelids, are no longer found in North America. So you literally, what I say tell people is like what they made was a gray wolf that's very similar to the niche of a dire wolf. These are the most dire wolf gray wolves you would ever see, but they are still gray wolves. And they're adding a species to a niche that no longer exists. Like, for instance, we know that dire wolves hunted mostly camels and horses. There are no indigenous camels or horses found in North America.
Yeah.
They're all horses now, thanks to Europeans bringing horses to North America back in the 1600s. But, like, true, like, living, breeding wild horses only found in some parts of,
Wyoming, Eastern Europe, things like that.
Desert. Like, it kind of brings up the ideas of, like, the whole, like, Pleistocene Park idea of, like, making an ecosystem around a species. Like, if you want to introduce like a prehistoric species, something like a dire wolf or a mammoth, first of all, you have to make the ecosystem that they once survived in, which climatically and things like that really isn't plausible in modern day science.
Yeah, no, we would have to go about terraforming things and stuff like that. Now, granted, we may be coming to a point planetary warmth wise where there are some species that we could be recreating their Pleistocene environment, you know. But once again, when you're talking about reintroducing a species into an ecosystem, that I mean, even when they talked about in all of a decade or so ago about repopulating Yellowstone with wolves.
Yeah.
Because that was something that was driven out for a long time, hunted out, all kinds of things. And yeah, it kind of wreaked havoc with the ecosystem when suddenly you have large predators like that are gone.
Yeah, like it's what we call a keystone species.
Yeah.
A species that is very key to the environment. And with these like dire wolves, let's just take, for instance, 10 years down the road, we have these new, what I like to call dire gray wolves. If we had a bunch of these and wanted to introduce them to the environment, like at least ecologically, it really wouldn't work out because their niche no longer exists. And also they would possibly outcompete indigenous species.
Yeah.
Like when people bring up these dire wolves, they're like, oh, well, it's what we call Anocyondyrus. These aren't really Anocyondyrus. I like to call these Canis lupus dyrus. They are a wolf that looks more like a dire wolf. But this brings up the ideas of like synthetic species and ideas of gene manipulation, which is, I will not take away from Colossal. This is a great step towards bioengineering and things like that. But what you really honestly need, and I bring into this is funding. Like this is a privately funded company that you need those big rewards, the extinction, dire wolf, to bring in funding science to really get your money from the public.
Well, and you know, that is once again, their stated goal is to repopulate a few species, thylacine being one of them, which once again was pretty well hunted to extinction by man. They had no natural predators except for us. And that may be an example, actually, of a species that, you know, fairly well, its habitat and its prey, would still be there.
Yeah, like, for instance, the thylacine, for instance, we noticed that thylacines, especially on Australia, actually died out a lot longer ago than we imagined because of dingoes and humans. But, for instance, like modern day Tasmania, it's still the same environment it was back in the 1930s and 40s when the thylacine supposedly went extinct. We still have still some sightings of them. So in my honest opinion, I don't think they're extinct in the first place.
Yeah.
But if we were to introduce them to the environment, they would make the same niche they did back 50, 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like there has been a rolling impact on the ecosystem, like the dire wolf, where it's like you're talking, what, 10 to 50,000 years ago was the last dire wolf. So that's a long gap of history and a lot of ecosystem change that you're talking about. And what's really interesting is that Colossal Biosciences, while yes, a private company, and raising tons of funds, things like that, has publicly stated that they intend to make zero money off of the actual work done. What they're going to make money off of is the licensing of the software for genetic research and things like that, you know, which is an amazing plan. And once again, a really, really great thing to see that there is a company with those efforts in place. But we have to ask, what is the upset to an ecosystem once you do that? And once again, I don't see necessarily an issue with this, because once again, very much a designer dog. They've taken a gray wolf, they've edited it, they've put it into a surrogate mother and given birth. It's basically an adapted gray wolf is what we have. So even if it gets out into the wild, what have you, it's not like you're going to have a whole lot of difference in gray wolf there. You're not going to have 8 foot tall wolves roaming around, you know?
Yeah, people, like, especially within cryptozoology, it brings up the ideas of, like, if these animals got loose, there's going to be a whole new cryptid on the field or something like that. It's like, these animals were literally just interbreed with gray wolves, and within a couple generations, the genes will disperse, and you might have a couple larger wolves, but that's pretty much going to be it. You're not making some new super species, which I feel a lot of people that are not really, I guess, not educated or not informed in the field of, like, biology and things like this, they think, oh, these people are playing God and are going to create some new Jurassic Park world full of, like, these monsters, they like to call them, which truly is not the intentions. It's like the ideas of just repopulating species. Like, for instance, yes, they get the dire wolf, but also not a lot of people are talking about, like what you said, the red wolves. Red wolves have created a genetic bottleneck because there's so little genetic dispersity and diversity. But with adding a couple more individuals to the population, you bring in new genetics.
That's right.
And you get out of that bottleneck, which these animals can do now. They're also doing things where, like, for instance, like, I think American chestnut tree. Yeah. Like, they're trying to edit the genes of the American chestnut, because back in the 40s, there was a plague that went across the Southwest that's a disease that kills American chestnuts. If you can alter some genes that will make it that you can fight that disease, you can repopulate a species.
Yeah.
With these dire wolves is that technically they only altered, like, I think, like, 14 different genes in the original, like, Canis lupus genes to make it look more dire wolf-like. But, like, I think they have about 20,000 genes in the first place. and only altered 14 in total. They just wanted to phenotypically look like a species, or not genetically look like a species. Like, this also brings about ideas of, like, what does species mean in the first place?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people think species, it can either diverge to what does it look like, or what is it truly genetics? Most scientists, modern day biologists, will say it's genetics that determines a species. While colossal, they're bringing on about an idea of, like, what does the phenotype, what does the morphology suggest for a species? Which, like, I kind of give people this idea. We're talking about dire wolves. Let's talk about another prehistoric species, the Smilodon fatalis, the saber-toothed cat. If we took a lion, made the fangs longer, made the tail shorter, made it more muscular, are we making a Smilodon? Or are we making a species of cat that looks like a Smilodon? It's kind of two different things. Like, kind of like a, what's the riddle, ship of Theseus. If you change all the parts of a ship, is it the same ship?
Yeah.
Is it still a lion with long fangs? Yes. It's not exactly a genotype of a Smilodon. It's not the genotype of a dire wolf.
Yeah. Yeah, it is of its own. And it's funny because in my conversation with my wife, she brought up the ship of Theseus concept. that is a decent question to ask and something decent to bring up because... There was a scientist from the Crick Institute that responded to this and was like, and I want to say there are like 22 edits, something like that, that they performed. And he was like, if we made 22 edits to a chimpanzee, would it be human?
No.
You know, does it change the species of the animal because you've made 22 edits to its genome?
Yeah.
You know?
Like, for instance, like, with chimpanzees and humans only having, like, one allele difference.
Yeah.
We only have, like, one or two alleles that are different. If we went in there and changed those alleles to human, are you suddenly making a human species now? Not particularly, because it kind of brings in a lot of perspectives that I don't think a lot of people have thought about of genetic manipulation into a new species.
Like, yeah.
That's why I kind of put forward the idea of these dire wolves should be called Canis lupus dyrus. This is technically kind of a new species. Like, let's just take, for instance, if they couldn't crossbreed with gray wolves, that's a suggestion of a new species. But if they could, then all these are just morphologically larger gray wolves.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, that in and of itself is okay to say, too, that we have genetically edited a gray wolf to basically have the same characteristics as a dire wolf. Because that in and of itself is an incredible leap when it comes to genetic manipulation and when it comes to, once again, successful genetic manipulation and surrogacy.
No. Like, for instance, like, the surrogate mom for these dire wolves was not a wolf in the first place. It was actually, like, a domestic dog, because domestic dogs can get a little bit larger than wolves.
Yep.
So they were able to breed and give birth to these dire wolves that are larger than actual gray wolves. And that's the interesting part that I'm really looking forward to in the future is how truly large are these animals going to get? Because Romulus and Remus and Khaleesi are not yet fully grown. And I think reports of what he's saying, they're like 140 pounds, something like that. So are these animals going to get to how large dire wolves got? Because dire wolves could get to about, I think, around 200 pounds. So, like, if these animals got to the size of like, dire wolves, we could see, okay, what is their niche? How do they act? And then give suggestions to maybe this is how prehistoric dire wolves looked like and acted. Because if we can learn from it from, like, paleontological record.
Well, and, you know, there have been numerous things about dire wolves over the last few years, not just Game of Thrones, but, you know, was it Skinwalker Ranch?
Yeah.
Where they found the skull that, like, the only way it could have been pierced in this way is a dire wolf
would
be able to exert. And it's... it's fascinating to go down those rabbit holes. It's amazing to think about those things, but it's not like, again, when you're talking about relict species, stuff like that, even species that have come back, you know,
things. Even Lazarus taxon, think went into world of cryptozoology. There's still a lot of people that think that dire wolves are still existing out in the wilderness. Yeah. Hell, some people think that dogman phenomena are surviving dire wolves that became bipedal. So that's one reason why I bring this up, especially with cryptozoology, is that, for instance, for people that bring up the ideas of dire wolves still existing, are they? Let's just take, for instance, if they start seeing these dire wolves now, these new dire wolves, will it alter people's perspectives on what they see in the wilderness? If people see these dire wolves in the wilderness, will they start seeing large white wolves? Because, for instance, one cryptid that's well known that's a giant white wolf is the Wahila. In Canada, it's suggested to be like a surviving dire wolf, supposedly.
Hmm.
Well, morphologically, it looks more like a bear dog, a whole other species of carnivore. But it's like really interesting when it comes to, like, especially cryptozoology and what people can think of genetic manipulation.
Yeah, precisely. And you know that, once again, the idea that many cryptozoologists have had that the dire wolf has continued as a species, and I don't know that I can necessarily agree with that.
It was a pack hunter. Things like that. Ecologically, we would have known they were there. If it was a pack of dire wolves roaming Yellowstone, we would see from prey deprivation, things like that, there is a weird pack of wolves out there. But ecologically, we just don't see that.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And once again, it's fun to go down those rabbit holes, but I can't necessarily follow them for a long time, because it's one of those. It's not necessarily like a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot, where it's like as long as a bear or something of similar size can subsist and exist in the area, there's no reason why the other couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily like cougars or red wolves or even gray wolves, you know, when you're talking about this, because the range would be different and the ecological diet would be different.
Some cryptozoologists and enthusiasts have brought up to me is like the ideas that like the American lion still exists in modern day North America. And I always tell people, I'm like, well, American lions killed mammoths and bison. I don't think that thing would be roaming around anymore, because its niche no longer exists.
Yeah.
Its prey species are extinct. So I don't think that's existing, but what can we see maybe, Felix Kunkula, the known cougar, kind of took up that range of being the large apex feline in North America. Even for a long time, the jaguar was a large feline in North America. So it kind of brings up ideas of just because something's prehistoric doesn't mean it's a good suggestion for explaining a cryptid and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, with that in mind, especially the idea of cryptozoology, things like that, especially when you're talking genetic editing, that kind of stuff. There have been stories for years about chimeras, chimeric labs. I mean, heck, I live in Austin. Right down the road is one of the labs that Alex Jones used to talk about. You know, they're out there genetically breeding monkeys and, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's an actual lab. I'd love to say it's not a real lab. And they are doing genetic tests on monkeys, all kinds of stuff. But are they creating chimeric creatures? Are they creating things that if they get loose, once again, I don't think that if the dire wolf pups get loose, that we're going to be worried about roving packs of dire wolves in the streets, you know? I don't think
every so often someone might see a giant gray wolf or Yellowstone, but that's going to be the extent of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, once again, even seeing how the wolves and their reintroduction to Yellowstone over the last few years have really made a difference to that ecosystem, and the way that it's impacted the ecosystem is fascinating to see. And when you're talking about the overall reintroduction of a species, that's something that you really, really have to, because once again, it's not like the continuance of a species like the Red Wolf Project.
No.
You know, where it's like, let's help breed more red wolves because they are necessary for the environment. These are animals that have been extincted, some of them by nature. So you do have to ask yourself, like, what's the efficacy of reviving the woolly mammoth? You know, other than to see if we can do it, why? Yeah. It's not like you're trying to save a species or something like that.
You know, like, even, like, for instance, like the woolly mammoth, like, it brings up ideas of, like, people see the woolly mammoth as, like, a symbol of de-extinction in general. Like, are we doing it just, like, as you said, that we can do it?
Yeah.
Or are we thinking about, like, what would the longevity be of these species? Like, for instance, like with the woolly mammoth, if we created one, all it really is going to be is like an Asian elephant with the genetics to look like a woolly mammoth.
Yeah.
So, like, what would the longevity of these species be? Because, for instance, there could be certain diseases, certain, like hopping up with dire wolf, because these animals are larger with more cells, would cancer be more common in these species? Would certain genetic animal maladies be common?
Like, you know, that's a really fascinating question to dive into. The idea of, because you have now taken the gene for mass and increased that in a species that typically would not have that mass, would that cause something down the chain to go awry as far as cell metastasization, things like that?
Yeah, like even, for instance, like how large these creatures are and how robust these are, like, they're going to act differently than what gray wolves act like. For instance, one big thing with gray wolves and dire wolves that are different is that gray wolves are persistence hunters. They chase down their prey for, heck, even hours at a time. We know dire wolves were built for quick hunting that was like quick attack, take you down strong because how strong they are. So how would these animals hunt? They have the genetics of a, like, of a gray wolf, but they have the morphology of a dire wolf. Like, it's the idea of, like, I think we brought this up before we came on, nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
Are these animals going to hunt like a gray wolf? Like, that's what their genetics say. But their body is built like a dire wolf. So how do these animals hunt? That's a lot of things that we have to kind of consider while looking at this new synthetic gray wolf.
Well, and with that in mind, even, would they even be accepted by a pack?
Yeah.
If they were introduced to a pack, you know, because of the genetic differences. I mean, heck, they'll gladly kill a pup that doesn't meet genetic snuff, no different than a bird will push one out of the nest if it doesn't genetically match up and gonna be strong. That's just nature. That's how that works, you know? So kind of the same question that, once again, that we brought up before air. I remember reading, whenever I read Jane Goodall's work, one of the chimps that had come back to the reserve was one that had been brought up with a family, you know, had gone to the refrigerator, gotten its own drink, you know, gotten its own apple and bananas, things like that. So it was brought up with very human interaction, and human interaction is very different than chimp interaction. We tend to look each other in the eye for affection. That's not the way chimps work. So when it was reintroduced to the population on the reserve, it was almost beaten to death by its fellow chimps, because it did not know how to socially interact in that kind of way, you know?
Yeah. Like, for instance, like, well, one thing, like, I've heard people bring up, like, with these, like, dire wolves. Oh, when we reintroduce them, when we introduce them. But I'm like, these animals were raised in a lab. Like, you, these three individuals were, they're on a reserve, but they would never be able to truly live in the wild and live on their own because they were raised in a lab around humans. And, like, that's the thing of, like, do these animals even know what they are? Like, like with the, does a chimp know it's a chimp when it's being raised around humans? Or does it just see itself as, like, a little hairy human? They don't know what they are until they're introduced to other fellows of their species. And with these, like, dire wolves, there are no other dire wolves out. So if they're introduced to, like, wolves, like a regular gray wolf, how would they react? There's a lot of stuff that brings up a lot of questions that we might never, ever get really answers to.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. Because, well, once again, when you're brought up under laboratory conditions, when you're brought up on a reserve, things like that, you've got a different level of interaction. You don't necessarily, I'm not going to say that you lose your instinct, but your instinct is honed in a different way.
Yeah.
So
I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the prime example of that, feel free to take a look at your domesticated dog, your domesticated cat. If you want to play with a cat, let it hunt. You know, give it. That's why a laser drives them crazy, because it's like seeing a bug. It brings out their hunting instinct in them, and their hunting instinct is no different than play, you know? Yeah. So yeah, it's, but if you take that house cat has been brought up, for 10 years and dump them in the middle of the woods, will they survive? Will they know how to hunt a bird? Will that instinct kick in that kind of way?
That's been shown, especially with feral cats, that within a generation or two, it does come back. Like,
oh, sure.
One that I've been doing a lot of research into recently is, like, the feral cats of Australia. Like, if you look into the feral cats of Australia, they're literally, like, the size of medium-sized dogs, because they're literally adapting morphologically to the environment. It's an environment without a large, like, a large carnivore except for dingoes.
Yeah.
So they're taking up that niche. They're literally evolving in front of our eyes, adapting to the environment.
Well, and, you know, a prime example that I bring up regularly with that is the domesticated pig.
Yeah.
You know, they are, their genes don't really change. They express themselves in a different way.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is if you take a domesticated pig and let them loose in the wild, they will immediately start growing thick hair. Their tusks will start coming back out, and their next litter of pigs, every one of them will come out like a wild boar.
Yeah.
Every like one of them.
Have you heard of hunters killing a wild boar? Do you look at the ear and they're like, this animal has a tag. It's a, it came from a farm when it was like a piglet, maybe even a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And has literally changed morphologically to adapt to being wild now.
Well, and that's honestly a huge theory on Hogzilla. You know, the idea of the massive, like, half ton pig that was killed is that it was actively a domesticated pig, which are bred to be larger. It got loose and went feral.
Yeah, like, this is an animal eating feed corn, not nuts and berries from the wild, because they are built to be larger when they're around humans. Like, this animal is literally eating the best food to make it bigger, and then it gets loose once it gets larger.
Exactly. And once again, just the genetic diversity of that, to see the fact that they are never more than a half step away genetically from their wild cousin. And that they immediately genetically revert back to that, that those traits come back as soon as they are back out in the wild. That's really a fascinating anomaly amongst the animal kingdom, because if you let a cow loose, it's not like they go feral, you know?
No. Like, it's even funny, like, while bringing up the ideas of genetic manipulation, while bringing up, like, with like cattle and stuff like that over in Europe, the Orlocks, the prehistoric cattle that was found in Pleistocene, like prehistoric Europe, back in the 40s and 50s, they literally would breed cows to look like the Orlocks. Like, it's a little known fact, but the Nazis actually bred Orlocks to look like these giant prehistoric cows because they saw them as like a way to hunt and things like that, like the Aryan idea. But Orlocks are literally almost newly around now again because we have genetically manipulated, not through like science, but like through breeding, to look like these prehistoric species. Like, it's a really interesting example of doing like what we did with direwolves, but with just some simple breeding.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, we had somebody ask, Michelle asked in the chat on YouTube, do we even know how many species there are on Earth? And no. I'll bring up the article in just a second, but I want to say that they recently announced that they believe that they've identified like 80% of the wildlife on Earth has been categorized. So no, we don't know everything. One of the prime things we talk about every time we have you on is that 70-year gap from interest to discovery. Yeah. You know, like the lowland gorilla, things like that. Numerous things like Sasquatch, that kind of stuff. We are just bridging that 70-year gap of scientific interest to scientific discovery.
Yeah. And like things like this, where like the dire wolf, like I love it going on right now because it helps bring science into the news, into the people's homes, talking about de-extinction, talking about species, because I'm a big paleontology guy. Like, literally, on my desk right now, I literally have a skull of a dire wolf. So it helps us, like, educate and inform others about really interesting species that once lived, that we can help, thanks to science like this, help educate others and inform others about.
Yeah. Yeah, and here is that article that I was, oh no, hold on, National Geographic won't let me in. I think I've read too many articles on air. but here it is from CNN. Scientists have identified an estimated 10% of all species on Earth. So, yeah, that's just what we've identified and categorized and given names to, things like that. So... and even it's something else that we bring up all the time on the show. We discover on average about 5,000 animals a year, even during COVID when the world was shut down. There were like 3,500 species defined. Now, granted, some of that was work that was going through the rungs and, you know, they were identified by somebody else. They're being confirmed by other scientists with the data and with the pictures, all that kind of stuff. But even during COVID, we confirmed like 3,500 new species.
Yeah. So like it sometimes I think about it, like being in the paleontology and dinosaurs, like, think of how many species lived and died and went extinct that we'll never know about. How many animals, thanks to just the lack of fossilization, we will never have any idea about. Like, just because there's maybe like one bone left of it and we haven't found it yet.
Yeah.
Like, people also have the idea like fossilization is also very uncommon in the first place. Yeah. Like, it only happens in very select areas. So how many species, like, tens of thousands, even millions of species we will never know about because of this lack of fossilization or discovery.
Yeah, no, precisely. The idea that, and you know me, I'm a rocks and minerals collector. I love fossils, stuff like that. There are places where you can go get tons of fossils, that kind of stuff. But those are like dried up parts of the ocean. You're gonna find like tons of snails and cordyceps and stuff like that. Finding full-blown fossils of mammals, that kind of stuff. Like when they found the mammoth in the permafrost, you know, like huge moment in science. It still had hair on it, you know. It was the same way with the dire wolf whenever they found it. Still had fur attached to the skeleton, that kind of stuff. These are permafrost finds. It's not like you can pull DNA from a fossil. It doesn't work that way.
No, because it's a rock. It's no longer a bone. It's mineral that's taken the shape of the bone, which I don't think even that's something people, not a lot of people know about. Like, for instance, we're bringing up ancient mammals. The two largest ancient mammal, three largest ancient mammal sites here in North America are literally what we call predator traps, or when a bunch of animals are in the same place. The La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. An interesting fact, not a lot of people realize, the other two places are right here in Texas. The Waco Mammoth Monument, which certain mammoths all died at once thanks to a flood, and Frizzlehan Cave down here in San Antonio, Texas. This is a cave that Homo Therium, a large prehistoric cat, literally went, it was a pride of them, lived there, died there, brought their kills there, and ultimately would all die there, and that's how we found their bodies. But even bringing up the ideas of, like, fossilization, think about it. A lot of West North America is known for dinosaur fossils and stuff like that. Yeah. Eastern United States isn't known for it because the soil is so acidic. So think of how many species are out there that we just don't know about.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Because they didn't fossilize. And even whenever it comes to Bigfoot, things like that, you know, one of those like, oh, we would have discovered it by now. Like, no, not really. There's still quite a bit of the United States that is not settled. And in addition to that, I challenge you to just like run across a bear skeleton, run across a full skeleton of a deer. It's a pretty rare find whenever you find a full skeleton like that, because most of the time predation happens. Even though predators maybe won't touch the guts, stuff like that, they'll gladly pull a hock off of it and walk off with a leg, you know, things like that. So it's pretty rare that you find full skeletons of anything, much less fossilized full skeletons of anything.
Yeah. And what you brought up is like the idea of like, there's still a lot of wilderness that we don't have any idea about. Like a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine was saying like, well, there's not a lot of wilderness out there. There's not a lot. I told him, okay, pull up on Google Maps, pull up Seattle, Washington. And it just starts zooming out and zoom out and zoom out and zoom out. And you're like, you go from city to green, 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 green. Cause that might be one of the largest cities that you could think of, but literally from everything from, you can say to like, Northern California all the way up to Alaska, there's unstoppable force. Like you can walk from Northern California up to Alaska without even seeing a human if you wanted to.
Yeah. And I've got the NASA map from the ISS up. Granted, this is 2012. However, feel free to take a look at that map, folks. You take it from just about East Texas over, like, the Houston and DFW area on the map and west, and there ain't a whole lot of city lights at night.
Yeah.
You know, there's some in California, there's some up there near Seattle and Oregon and that kind of stuff. But aside from that, it's pretty well empty.
Yeah.
You know,
I like to tell people, especially here in Texas, we are a country of wilderness with pockets of humanity.
That's right.
Like, we have the little pocket from city, take a highway to another city, take a back road to another town. But ultimately, it's a lot of wilderness and a lot of natural spaces that
people
don't explore anymore. Like, you don't have the frontiersmen like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett anymore out there with a bowie knife and a musket just exploring just to explore.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. And it's also one of those, when you're talking about biodiversity, when you're talking about this kind of stuff, those things are massively important. It's something that we talk about all the time with King Gerhardt, even the idea of, and Craig Wolheater, who wrote the Bigfoot conservation law that went into effect up there in Jefferson in Marion County, the idea of, If this species exists, we need to protect its environment, you know? Once again, when you're talking about a de-extincted species, That is something that you have to consider, is the environment that you would be putting it in. Would it be able to survive that environment? And granted, it's not like they have brought back the actual direwolf. I don't think a direwolf would be able to survive in the same situations that a modern day gray wolf would, but so a variant of a gray wolf would.
Yeah, maybe some locations up in Alaska and Canada, but like, if you want to introduce these species to like Texas or like even Wyoming, I'll even bring up, like, they probably wouldn't be able to survive because of this lack of prey and like this lack of ecology that would be able to sustain them. Which this is also another issue why I love bringing up this topic, because like the ideas of ecology and a lot of that stuff is very misconstrued or like misunderstood by people. And like this really helps show ecology of like, no, like ecology's change, environments change. Like that's even like within the span of time, 12,000 years doesn't seem that long, especially with life. But like ecologically, it's very much a long time. Like, well, especially with the megafaunal extinction that happened at the end of the Pleistocene, like animals that we would bring back from the Pleistocene wouldn't be able to survive because the animals they lived alongside have been extinct. We would have to literally bring back a whole ecosystem in order for one species to survive.
Yeah, you'd have to bring back its prey items, things like that. It's communal species that it lives alongside of, because, you know, species do not exist in a vacuum.
No.
There is a give and a take in nature. So when you lose one, the others are affected, and often not in a great way. It can sometimes take generations for them to recover from the loss of that cooperative species that they live in conjunction with.
Yeah. Like, you never know. Maybe 10 years down the line, we'll see Colossal coming out with a giant short-faced bear, but like the possibility of bringing back a whole environment compared to just one species.
Yeah.
It's possible. Like, for instance, the Pleistocene Park up in Siberia that they're working on, like there is an area of mammoth steppe that still exists that we could bring back these species. And they actually are bringing back species that were indigenous to that location. They're shipping them from other parts of Europe to there. But the actual ideas of like doing areas of like North America and stuff like that, bringing back a whole environment, is just very impossible. It's possible, but very implausible.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And the idea of that, the idea of, I'm bringing that up on screen right now, Pleistocene Park.
Yeah. What we're talking about, wild horses, they're literally bringing back, they brought wild horses from Mongolia. They've brought some wolf packs from Europe, and they're trying to bring back this mammoth steppe that used to exist back then. This is why when you bring up the ideas of like bringing back the mammoth, this is probably where they would be introduced at. Like, this is an area that the environment literally already exists. So if you brought back a species, like a keystone species like a mammoth, they probably would be able to survive because the environment already exists for it.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. The basically where they lived is already still there. It's fascinating to think about those things. The idea that, once again, we have the ability to do this. The question is, should we be doing this? You know, once again, when it comes to the direwolf, I think this is a fantastic, really, really awesome display of what genetic editing can do and the possibilities behind genetic editing. Not a clone. Let's be very clear about that. It is not an actual, quote, direwolf in that kind of way. It is a gray wolf with some edited genetic direwolf traits. And we'll see what happens when, because I'm sure on that preserve that they will eventually begin breeding these. So we'll see what happens, because unfortunately, I suppose with one of them named Khaleesi, that there's a female. But once again, you're starting off in a hobbled way with very little biodiversity at that point. You're talking about
siblings, genetically. So it's like, with interbreeding, you would have to bring back more for them to breed with in order to make a viable population.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, really what you'd have to do is probably bring in a gray wolf for them to breed with, and start the diversity in that kind of way. But you'd end up very rapidly with it, because most dog species that exist out there, we have bred. We made them that way. We bred them because of their traits. And a prime example of that would be the Dalmatian, unfortunately, due to the extreme breeding of the Dalmatian with Dalmatian for Dalmatian traits, you now end up with a good percentage of the Dalmatian population, which is deaf.
Yeah.
That's like, one of the byproducts of the inbreeding.
Yeah. Like, for instance, especially because that's one thing that's interesting with people that don't know, like, the ideas of all these dog breeds only really popped out around late 1800s, early 1900s, because that's when the dog, like dog show, became popular. So a lot of these modern species are very much modern species.
That's right.
Ideas of like ancient species like chihuahuas and things like that go back thousands of years. But a lot of species, a lot of these breeds we see now are very modern, only popped up like past 50 years. And that also causes a lot of genetic abnormalities. Like, I always say, look at a pug. Look at a pug. That, I'm sorry, little guy, you're not supposed to look like that. Like, when people bring up the ideas of, like, playing God and playing stuff like that, we've been doing that for thousands of years. Like, look at how dogs came. Like, they looked like wolves, and now we have Yorkshire Terriers and pit bulls.
Yeah. And that brings up something else. We've only got you for a few more minutes, Ryan. But even the idea of crossbreeding, even the idea of genetic crossbreeding, it's one of those, like, there becomes a barrier genetically that you really can't cross. And, it'd be kind of like a mountain lion trying to mate with my house cat.
Yeah.
They're both cats. They're both felines. However, there is an epigenetic barrier and a genetic barrier that exists there that wouldn't be able to happen.
Yeah. Like, when people think about chimpanzees and humans, the Soviet experiments with making super soldiers mixing us with chimpanzees, due to the epigenetic variation, we wouldn't be able to do that. But yet, other human species we would, like Neanderthals or Homo erectus, because we are more related to those species, because they are also other human species.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And these things, once again, getting into the world of chimeras, stuff like that, we should really do a whole episode on that sometime, man, because it's a fascinating thing. And an amazing subset of the world of cryptozoology and paranormal research. You know, you start getting into things like the Montauk Monster, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And,
Man and Goat Man and all these, like, modern cryptids.
So it's interesting, and it's interesting to see, once again, a lot of this episode, folks, was done to help demystify, as many of our episodes are done to do. It's one of those, I think people have a lot of knee-jerk reaction and a lot of misunderstanding. They immediately hear genetic and start thinking about things like Jurassic Park. And it's like, no. Yeah. Not what this is.
That's fiction.
There's still some genetic work in there. And kudos to Colossal Biosciences, no doubt. Like, I would still love to have them on the show if anybody out there listening is connected, to talk with them about this and to talk with them about their literal colossal efforts, because it's amazing. And the idea of repopulation is amazing, but we do have to be very careful, with the sensationalism and with the idea of like a revived species. An extant species that has been altered to resemble an extinct species. It would be the very precise way to put it.
The difference between de-extinction and synthetic.
Yeah.
Like, that difference.
Yes, and that's a great definition to put on there, synthetic de-extinction. You know, the idea that, like, yes, you have brought back a critter with the characteristics of this from an existing species, but you have not brought back the actual species of dire wolf, because it was a divergent species to begin with. It wasn't wolf. So, Ryan, thank you so much, as always, for coming on. Thank you so much for the time, bud. It's always great chatting with you. This was a great topic tonight. Thanks so much for bringing that up and cueing me to do this episode. I've been looking forward to it for the last week or so since we decided to do it. Before we let you go, where can everybody go to find your work? Where can they go to keep up with you? All that good stuff.
Of course. I have my social medias. I am fairly easy to find. I'm on my Facebook, my Instagram. I also do live events. I have lined up at multiple conferences this year.
Yep.
If anyone's heard of the Texas Bigfoot Conference up in Jefferson, Texas, I'm actually the first time ever speaking at that conference, which I can't even imagine this is reality in the first place.
Yeah.
I'm also speaking at the Alabama Bigfoot Conference in June. Yeah, and then also we'll be not presenting, but I will be one of the guests at the Crossing Realms conference up in Missouri in September.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun one. I'm looking forward to it. Ryan, thanks so much for the time tonight. It's always great chatting and catching up with you. Of course, folks, make sure next week to go to San Antonio and check out Symposium of the Strange. We'll be talking about remote viewing this month. We'll have Greg Radabaugh there talking about the amazing world of remote viewing, all kinds of fun stuff. So
it's going to be a really interesting show to watch.
It's going
to
be a fun one. It's going to be a fun one.
I'm excited to learn a lot more about it.
Absolutely. Ryan, you take care of yourself, bud. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. All right.
You too, bud.
Great, my friend. While you are online checking out everything from Ryan Edwards, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of Ryan's books in Curious Realm's bookstore as well. So stop on by and check that out. When we come back from this commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend Jared Murphy as well as Christy Bass from ArchaeoX. We will be talking about a complex that they have been busy uncovering in Belize, and how you can get involved with that effort right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for holding on through that quick commercial break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They are your source and my source for amazing CBD products. They are right here in Austin, Texas. Christopher Lynch uses an amazing spigeric process using every part of the hemp plant, from seeds to stems to to roots, buds, leaves, every part of the plant is used, combusted, and reused to make an amazing full-spectrum CBD product. Some of the only ones I have actually found as far as CBD products go that have terpene profiles attached to them so that you can get the best healing properties that you can get for what you need. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com. That is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $100 or more and get two, count them, two free edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Jared Murphy and Christy Bass. They are from ArchaeoX. We have had them on. We've had Jared on numerous times. We had Christy on during his last appearance to talk about their recent trip to Belize, uncovering a complex down there and some of the things that they have been able to not only uncover, but to help out with the local area. Welcome back to the show, Jared and Christy. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to come back on. I am excited to see that you guys are actively going back. May 30th to June 8th, y'all have a week-long expedition down there. Before we get into that, let's get into the beginning of things. Jared, how did you first come to find out about this complex down in Belize? Because I know a couple years ago I was supposed to go with you, I guess last year, to Belize. My passport did not come in on time, but the results of what y'all did, even in the first trip, were absolutely amazing. How did you come to find out about this piece of property to begin with?
Well, the most logical answer to that is for me to tell you a crypto conference in Utah, in downtown. Okay. That's the perfect way to learn about Mayan ruins. I was asked to speak on a board, on a panel at a, it was a crypto conference in downtown Salt Lake City. And one of the members approached me and said, "Hey, based on your background and what you do, I own thousands of acres in Belize.
Wow.
And suspect that there are Mayan ruins. And it seems like you do expeditions and find things." And I said, I have at that point, Tom Elmore of the GeoNav Group and I were friends, and we were already looking for something, some way to apply GP, ground penetrating radar, all of it. And so, yeah, I put together a team and we went looking, and we were, that's where we were. I was in Salt Lake City at a crypto conference.
Wow. And you know, it really does go to show you that I make the example all the time, even with my business, people that I met 12 years ago, it has come full circle. And it's funny how those strange little things like that end up working out for amazing reasons. Like, you randomly went to go speak at a cryptocurrency conference, and ended up talking to somebody about something totally different, that has led you down this amazing path of discovery. Now, when was the first expedition? When did you guys get back from that? What did y'all uncover in the first expedition?
Yeah, the one you were supposed to go on.
Yes.
What happened was, so the first thing was, hey, we have to go at this in a logical way, which is satellite imaging. So we did that first, and Christy wasn't involved yet, but we were already looking actively for a LIDAR company. And it turned out that we were, we're going to go on this expedition. So we had doctors, we had basically, what are we going to run into, because we're going to be in the actual jungle. And then we had the idea for video and film, which is how you came up. And we definitely wanted to have a documentation part of it, not just for the trip itself, but also to look at how could we bring this to the general public as a show, perhaps. But we didn't know what we were going to find. We didn't know what the show would be about. So we were able to use satellite imaging to identify 30 targets of what we thought were suspicious anomalies of what could be either Mayan buildings or ruins or pyramids. And we set out with a bushman. And so we had a guide, and we got backpacks and first aid kits. And we, an hour and a half, just no different than Indiana Jones. We ended up in the jungle, and we day one, target one, we just chose one of the targets, and it turned out to be a massive archaeological theft site where they were in the middle of, you know, basically they had spent weeks systematically digging and finding what turned out to be $2.5 to $3.5 million worth of artifacts. So that was our day one in the jungle.
Wow. Wow. And, yeah. You know, just the scope of this place, once again, to hear somebody say that that they own a few thousand acres. Yeah. How big is the area that you guys are working presently?
I don't know.
400
acres.
Wow. But that's still massive.
Well, because the site that we're on is about by, I hate to say the crow flying, but it is extremely close to where the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull was found.
Wow.
At Lubantun. So yep. This entire area is really probably a single Mayan metropolis that went on for many square miles, but the site is officially 400-ish, but yes. It's not. It's really in the middle of a massive Mayan empire that they just live on and deal with.
Mm-hmm. But that is still huge. I mean, when you start looking at, I mean, even 40 acres is about a quarter mile, something like that. So if you're talking, you know, something that large, that's a expansive property to have access to for exploration. How much of that is under active excavation right now?
Oh, Chris, yeah, the site where there was a massive archaeological theft, when I say massive, the site that was privately owned was over 8,000 acres.
Wow.
So it was many miles by somewhere. So like our first day out hiking, we hiked closer to 7 miles and five, and that was through the jungle and up and down what were really bluffs. So that was actually a pretty intense day. I cannot thank the trees enough. Being in the shade in Belize is significantly better than being in the sun.
Yeah.
And it's filled with razor grass, which is grass that grows to 12 feet and is as sharp as razors. There's no going around it. And for those, so for us to hit an archaeological theft. So when I say thefts, I think exactly Indiana Jones with all the tents, cooking. They had tents for sleeping. They had tents for working. They had tents for tools. They had a systematic setup for a kitchen. So they weren't just digging in a hole. They were systematically digging for what turned out to be maybe Olmec, Toltec, pre-Mayan artifacts. And so we were able to set out and prove that ArcuX, which was really in its inception. Also, the trip, if I haven't pointed out to everyone listening, was a trip you were supposed to be on.
Yeah. Yeah. The universe, once again, conspires in strange ways.
So there we were, you know. So it was quite an adventure to find that. And how it led us to where we're working is we have to deal with our guide's schedule. And it was a day where we could not, because we have to first take a 90-minute boat ride up the coast of Belize, land, literally beach, get out in the water, like a beach landing.
Wow.
And port all our gear to the shore. There's a lot of logistics to really being in the jungle for real. And that takes a lot of efforts, and he wasn't available. So we went driving with our group. There's about 10 of us in a couple large vehicles. And there was a site that was closed to the public, but it was in a small village. And we stopped, and I met the mayor, who came up to me, and then we got talking and what the ruins were. And then fast forward, here we are, Christy and I and our partner, Tom Elmore, we ended up combining forces to continue the ArcuX goal of exploration, expeditions, and had the opportunity to actually dig and actually clean this pyramid complex. So it's multiple buildings, multiple constructions on a site that is completely entangled in the jungle. So to get there, this expedition, that was a pretty monumental effort, actually.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, just the idea of, once again, exploring a complex that large, how do you came into things, Christy, through the 3D scanning side of it, correct?
Yeah, sort of. Correct. Tom reached out, our partner Tom, who they were obviously partners before I came on board.
Yeah.
Reached out to the company I was working for. We do aerial LIDAR and imagery. And he reached out to get a quote for us to fly down and do, we did a 400 acre quote of just the complex. And then we also did a 4,000 acre quote, because with LIDAR, what, you know, the biggest cost for that project was the mobilization to get down there. It's not actually flying the project itself.
Yeah.
So we thought, you know, the idea behind it was, if we're going to pay to have LIDAR flown, then we would do the 4,000 acres instead of 400, because we're already there. So we would just grab it while we were up there. So yeah, they reached out, and that's kind of how it started. And then it was just kind of a snowball from there.
Yeah. I dared her to come, and here we are.
Yeah. I was at a conference in Nashville last March when he called, and we, you know, kind of visited for a little bit, and he was like, "So I think you should come to Belize." I was like, "Cool,
yeah,
good, yeah."
And what has your experience been on property so far, Christy? You've had the opportunity to be there, scan. What kind of things have you discovered, especially with the technology that you're using?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we found really fascinating was we walked a LIDAR handheld unit through the compound. And what we noticed, not just at the ruins that we were working at, but at Lubuntun and Nimlipunit. So at all of the sites that we would walk the scanner through, if you were in close proximity to the ruins, it wouldn't turn on. It wouldn't work. So we would have to step away from the ruins, turn the scanner on, and then make our way back in slowly to grab imagery of it, because it wouldn't turn on. So we don't know if there was some sort of a magnetic anomaly some sort of, I don't know, magnetic field or something energetically was happening for sure.
Well, you know, and it definitely, whenever you're talking anywhere in that area, the whole place is limestone. That tends to jack with things a little bit, especially water running through limestone. That in and of itself will cause electromagnetic phenomena, so to speak. Kind of like water running through a copper pipe, you'll actively get a voltage off of it. So interesting though that your equipment would not turn on the site, but adjacent to it, absolutely. That's quite phenomenal, quite literally. Now, with that in mind, how long did it take you, Jared, to get permission? Because a lot of people don't realize, number one, you can't just go start digging somewhere. Even if you own the property necessarily, you can't just go start digging somewhere. You have to get permits, things like that. Almost like, sure, I could probably plant a small shrub in my backyard. If I wanted to, put an in-ground pond in, I'd probably have to talk to my HOA and get a permit to do so. And very much the same thing with archaeological digs, things like that. What was it like dealing with the localized government, things like that? How did that relationship come to be?
Oh, it was just great and easy, and they were wonderful to work with.
Yeah?
No. I mean, yes, that's the right answer, Chris, because we have to keep dealing with all of them.
Well, absolutely. But what were some of the hoops that you had to actively jump through? What were some of the things that you had to deal with? Because I'm sure it's not just like, hop down to Belize, fill out Form 123A, and there you go. You know,
I would like that world. The problem is there are layers in obviously every government.
Yeah.
And in this case, the Mayans have their own relationship to the land and they live collectively. So at one layer, there's the fact that no one individually owns anything. There are no, you can have a home and they will vote. And the person says, well, I want to build a home here on these 2-3 acres and they're going to be my acres. But that's given by the community. So you have a village of about 800 people, 600 voters that literally decide who gets what, mm-hmm. and how they're going to share. And then the village itself says, well, we're Mayans and this is our land. The Belizean government then says, well, we're Belize and they were founded by the British and they have rules, but the rules to go buy a condo on an island or to live in Belize and be an expat, you know, if you want to go down there and own something, you can do that. But to own land in a Mayan village is currently impossible.
Yes.
So there's a layer of government where you have to get the community itself, where we've had to have multiple meetings with the communities. Then there's the National Institute of Culture and History that controls all Mayan roots. And they are completely different than any of the Mayans or the groups that run the villages. So we have to deal with the village community and leadership. We then have to get NICHE to deal with the community and leadership. Then we have to deal with NICHE, the National Institute of Culture and History. Am I making this more boring? Can I?
Like it's, I said,
it's just a lot of red tape.
Yeah. No, and that's just it. And that's kind of what I want people to understand is that it's not like this just happened overnight. It's not like you got access to somebody's property and you got to go out with a shovel the next weekend and start digging and excavating property. Things like that. That is not how it works. It's something that we brought up like whenever we did our episode on the Jaime Musan skeletons. It's one of those like, you know, I'm pretty sure you didn't just like bring those from Peru. There's a little bit that you have to go through, A, to get a skeleton, B, to bring it across international borders. Most average listeners don't understand the fact that there's a little bit that goes into that and a lot more than just like, hey, we heard there's something here. We'd like permission to dig. You know, there's local culture, there's local jurisdiction, and beyond that, there's tribal jurisdiction. Like you said, you can't even own a piece of property on a Mayan site. And with that being said, of course, Belize itself is a, you know, fairly English-speaking area. But what about the area that you are in and that you are actively excavating? What is the access to things like that? Do you have to have a local linguistic guide, somebody who speaks Mayan, things like that?
No, we don't. We have, fortunately, the first language, of course, being British, it's the only English-speaking country in Central America officially, but they speak 2 dialects of Mayan. The villagers are trilingual at least, because some of them also speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. But we can deal with the villagers directly in English. But that in itself is kind of a bit of a system. And then the other hurdle, one more that I didn't mention, is that there are other colleges, there are anthropologists and there are archaeologists that have already done work in Belize. And so there are people who are actually politically very territorial towards not only what they're investigating, but also their access. They tend to think that World Heritage is their individual ownership. So another layer of this is working around other people's ideas of their contributions to history. Yeah. So part of it is, so there's a dynamic not only with the village and the villagers and basic communication with culture between the Mayans and the Belizeans, which are, they're different because there's multiple cultures. There's Creole. Yeah. There's a Caribbean culture that is not at all related to the Mayans. And then there's an English culture. And then with the collegiate part of all the different excavations that are going on with all the different institutions around the world, you're dealing with an international community that is entirely separate from everything we just mentioned, but still all interact with NICHE. So it's daunting. So in the 3 seconds it took me to call up Christy and say, hey, do you want to go to Belize? The amount of hours that I have personally spent.
Yeah.
To get to that question was tremendous.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Does anyone care?
I do, because if it weren't for you doing all of the work, I wouldn't have, you know, been able to go.
The main thing is that without doing the work, once again, there are good relationships with archaeology and there are bad relationships with with archaeology. Mm-hmm. And much like Salem, Massachusetts, as we know it, could have gone horribly awry. and it's a fact, you know, even now, you know, the community could utterly not embrace it. They could not want it.
Oh, yeah.
And when that happens, you know, great that these things are good for tourism, but does the community embrace it? And typically, if they don't embrace it, it's because of previous situations. One of the examples I give regularly on the show is Falk, Arkansas, with the Falk Monster, which Falk Monster Fest is coming up this weekend. But it's one of those, the community, many of them, especially the old timers, things like that, would much rather all the looky-loos go away. They would much rather people just forget the town of Falk and what it's known for in that right and not come there for that, because it has led to bad things in their history. And many is the time that archaeology is the same way, where once again, you end up with sites being robbed. You end up with sites no longer being accessible to local population because of rules, things like that, because of whatever international body the governance of that area is now given to, you know. Yeah. So the access to those things can very rapidly and easily be taken away from a local indigenous population.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the big arguments, one of their concerns. So in one of our, Tom Elmore and I, we went back down and we had another meeting. So prior to the trip with Christy and our group that went, Tom and I and we had a small group that went down and we went to Niche. We went to the offices and we met the mayor of the village. And then we went and had meetings with the community. So we had a whole extra week in Belize prior to our ultimate expedition to clear the ruins. So to get first and foremost, what you said was true. You can't just go to Belize and clear ruins or do something. You can't just go and do that. So for us to get that approval took a lot of phone calls, a lot of communication, a lot of emails, but then it took an extra trip to go down there for us to actually communicate directly with Niche, which was complicated, at say the least. And then with the community itself, if it wasn't for the mayor of this city, if it wasn't for him specifically, we would not have been able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and that's just it. The localized part of this is what I love. The way that the community has catalyzed behind this, the way that the community, it's creating not only jobs in the community, but also helping out with education, things like that as well.
Yeah. The education piece is huge. I have to acknowledge some people that are helping us with computers. We're bringing down some things to help the school.
Oh, awesome.
We're hoping to do some more humanitarian work. This is, of course, for our Christy, maybe we should actually mention we're inviting people back.
Yeah.
So something that I'd like to also talk about with ArchaeoX is when I was invited down there on the last expedition, my head was not wrapped around what ArchaeoX was until I actually got down there. We've got an education component and a humanitarian component. So one of the things that's really important to us as a company is plugging into the communities that we work with.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we're doing when we go back is installing solar panels on the school. So we're looking for a sponsor for solar panels. We prefer them to be in country because the cost of shipping and there's, you know, batteries weigh a lot and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple of main areas for water sources, like the community center and the school. We installed some water filters when we were there to filter water, but they were kind of
They work.
They work, but it just doesn't filter enough water fast enough, really, to make that big of a difference. And so we're that's another thing that we're looking for is installing a bigger water filter system. And then they have a problem in the school with bats getting into the school. So we're putting up screens around the top of that. They have thatched roofs down there. So actually they have, I think there are metal roofs on the school. Is that right?
They like to call them zinc.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're metal roofs, but
yeah. So that's another huge component of what we do is we plug into the local communities and help where, you know, we figure out what the need is. And then, you know, like he said, we're bringing computers down and solar panels and,
the actual research we're going to share with the schools, because we're trying to build something for American schools for, creative history, anthropology, stuff like that. But in return, we're trying to return the curriculums in a way that schools locally can use them at either a discount or complete free for the local Belizeans to share in their own culture, but to also pair those schools with maybe American counterparts that they can interact with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Being able to build those bridges between educational communities where three students from a university here can swap with three students down there, and they can exchange educational opportunities, the cultural opportunities of exploration, things like that. It's hugely important, especially with specialized fields. You know, I know you and I were talking the other day, Jared, just about the cultural exchange programs that my college had, where it was like, oh, so you're studying Spanish, hop on down to this, you know, small Guatemalan town for like 6 weeks. And like kids would go down there for like their 3.5 week Christmas break, stuff like that, and do like a Spanish learning intensive, stuff like that, where it's like, you ain't not learning Spanish. Like it's happening. You were just literally dropped in the middle of a village that does not speak English. So good luck with that.
Right.
By the time you came back, like you were normally pretty fluent in Spanish in like 3.5 weeks. It was pretty incredible. You know, like,
immersion, I think, is the best way to learn those languages.
Oh, absolutely. Period. Yeah. I mean, immersion is typically the easiest way to learn a culture, learn the education of a culture, learn even the history of one.
Right.
So, being able to even... because sadly, and I will give Salem, Massachusetts as an example again, all too often and sadly, education does not include local education. You would think that if you lived in Massachusetts, Salem, Massachusetts would be like on the docket from kindergarten through graduation as a class trip, right? It's not. Yeah. It's not. You would think living in Texas that going to see the Alamo would be like a class trip.
But you know what?
At least in school from junior high to high school. It's not.
Chris, I was raised in Texas, and that's not the case. I was raised to Texas. And do you know who's been to the Alamo? I've never been to the Alamo.
No, that's what I'm saying, is that it's not a required part of Texas education. It should be.
Just makes you northern.
So
I was raised in Texas.
Just
so the idea that these people take it for granted that this is in their backyard. Like when my wife's first time to go to Salem, Massachusetts was with me. She grew up 20 miles down the road.
Oh, wow.
What?
She grew up in Massachusetts, 20 miles down the road from Salem, had never been there, literally. So it's very much the same way in local community, in tribal communities, things like that, because oddly enough, you're way too busy actually living your life and trying to just live than to be able to take the opportunity to go rediscover a lost part of your history, you know? So the fact that you guys are including this and are getting the local education system involved with it is fantastic. It's awesome. Like I myself, as a Cajun, it's one of the things I bring up regularly on the show. You are hard pressed to find a Cajun my mother's age who is 100% Cajun, who actively speaks Cajun.
Really?
It is one of the only languages indigenous to the United States, and in one generation, it's almost gone.
That's crazy.
It wow. does not take long for us to forget our history.
That's mm-hmm. true.
So the fact that you have these opportunities to bring local students, bring young students to rediscover is something that's literally in their backyard.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's literally in their backyard to the point where it looks like there were standing yes. stones that had hieroglyphs on them. They're literally falling over, and Alfredo's just walking us over them. And I'm like, they got pigs, it's their front lawn.
And don't get me wrong, like, I guarantee you, there are stories amongst the locals about what happened, what the city was, what it was used for, things like that. But to scientifically rediscover that. To rediscover these places and show them and be able to say, like, this is where this happened. Like, this yeah. is the location. Those things are massively important to rediscover.
It is. And it's not, again, we keep coming up with LIDAR scans that are showing, look, another plane has found another metropolis in Mexico or whatever. And we keep implying tens of millions of Mayans, but it's ridiculous at this point. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear that the Mayan Empire was way further along and together longer than the Egyptians and longer than the Romans.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear that they were pretty much everywhere. And so it's pretty significant the ruins that they're living on, but are they doing something with it? Are they educating? Are they able to participate? Are they able to, part of it is to bring humanitarian aid and education, but part of it is how can RQX interact with a community and make it sustainable? In education and also for tourism, how do we participate in a way that keeps it sustainable? That is something that we're discovering. And
well, and also you know, adds to the quality of life for the villagers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. Every bit of that, every job that is created in the localized area, the just not too long ago, it was in. Yeah. October, I took the remote viewing cruise. And one of the stops that we went to was the Chachobin ruins. That was a pretty amazing complex. It was really cool to see what had been uncovered, things like that. But that was discovered in 94. So, and the fact that they were just getting to the uncovering of things, stuff like that, here in the last 5-10 years is when the major part of excavation has been done. So that is how long, extrapolated a timeline, you can sometimes be looking at before, hey, here's a site, we discovered it, and now it's excavated enough to be able to sell tickets and to be able to have a tourist trade, things like that. You know, that's a crazy timeline. And to see that you guys are already to the point of having uncovered things, you are already to the point of at least archaeological tourism, where it's even the fact of come help us dig, you know, come be a part of the active excavation, things like that. That is amazing that you guys have already progressed to that point, Jared.
Well, yeah, locating, that's another layer of permitting for us to locate archaeologists that are friendly to writing permits for us to do what we want to do and to team together. So, and you and I were talking about this on the phone the other day, getting, I think Christy and I, to get a team together that would invite anthropologists or students from any college.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be one college. It could just be,
that's right,
come down and spend 10 days and, you know, find your own mine ruins.
Well, and once again, just the idea of a study abroad, that's basically a study abroad concept for archaeologists, where it's like, because it can be hard. I have known people that have gone for paleontology degrees and things like that. And when it comes time for field work and lab work, it's often very, very hard to find an active dig site to become a part of. To go get your certifications, to go do that kind of stuff. So it's incredible the opportunities that you guys have in front of you for building things like that.
It is. There's a lot of opportunity. I mean, thank you for helping us, helping just come up with some of the ideas too.
Absolutely. Well, and with ideas in mind, things like that, what are some of the wishes? What are some of the things that you guys see for this property? What are some of the goals, let's say, in the next year and a half that you guys have?
Well, we want to go back and do ground penetrating radar because we believe that there are tombs.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's the site that we are clearing right now. We're not able to dig yet. So hopefully that's coming in the future, but there's definitely more to be found.
I like Chris's question. What else would we want to do in the next year and a half?
Oh God. Honestly, I just want to make a documentary and travel the world and document like all of the underground caves and
tunnels.
And tunnels that are under these ruin sites. Because a lot of these ruin sites, that's what they're built on top of.
Yeah.
Of other structures and cities that are underneath the surface. And I think that that's where our answers are.
Yeah.
You know, when we're researching human antiquity and where we come from and, you know, how these structures were built and who built it and all of those things, we're seeing that across continents that there's a connection of some global society. So I think that when we start digging below the surface of these structures, that's where we're really going to find the answers. So in the next year, if I could just, what my wish would be, would be Belize and Peru and Egypt. And we would, that's what we would do is research underneath the structures, not just the structures themselves, but underneath.
And the tunnel systems, like, again, we all like to point out like Eric Von Daniken and Buzz Aldrin going to those tunnel systems in Peru or you know, Bolivia, you know, the places where they're like, hey, there's these rock cut systems. It's like, okay, well, let's put a more of a tape measure, more of a actual, you know, the Christopher Dunn style billionths of an inch sort of corners of things. Let's look for tool cuttings and marks that show maybe high speed tooling cutting, or not just that maybe they were laser cut, but what are some of the things that are in these tunnel systems? Let's go back. We know that Eric Von Daniken mentions it, but Brian Forster mentions them, but we need to go and like, it'd be nice to document what it actually looks like. Mm-hmm. No one does that. So we want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And being able to, being able to get access to that stuff with equipment can be very hard. Like you said, even the property that you guys go to in Belize, it's not like you take a, you know, 4x4 up the road or something like that. You have to actively get on a boat to get access to the place.
You know why though, on that note, the reason we were taking the boat is because the land route does exist, but it's, anyone out there who's listening, imagine a Jeep commercial where they show you what a Jeep can do, but it's all bright and shiny, but it's going through mud, but it's going through like really rough ground. So the rainy season turns all the dirt roads into exactly that commercial, but it's not for 30 seconds. It's the road in is an absolute mess and it's approximately 5 miles. So the road into the property where we were on the private land that was 7,000 acres road in, we did it. Ironically, we did it twice, and then we had to build. We actually watched our bushman chop down a large tree to then chainsaw cut thick boards for our our trucks to drive over a stream, and that's how we got in twice.
Oh.
And between the two times, someone stole the boards that were cut.
Oh,
they're in the jungle. It's like they could just smell free shit.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, when you run across two perfectly good milled planks of wood in the jungle, you don't leave them there.
But they were like, they were the kind of things that you make a countertop out of or a bar.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
20 feet long.
I was like, somebody's got a nice workbench right now.
In the middle of the jungle. That wasn't like at the start, Chris. That wasn't like you turn off the freeway and there's boards. No, we're talking 3.5 miles in.
That sounds to me like somebody was trying to set you up for disaster. How are you going to get back out?
Well,
right.
Fortunately, they didn't take them until we were gone. So when we came back the next day, we finally just said, oh, the hell with it. The next time we came out on the road route, because we kept coming by boat mostly. So it wasn't like the next day. But the next time we came out through road, which again was a splashy, horrible, like definitely didn't want to eat. If you have any motion sickness, this is this is not friendly driving. This was pretty badass and epic and exactly the Jeep commercial, except for like an hour. And really significantly shaky baby. But when we get out there, you have to drive those first few miles. That's public Belizean land that is forested by forest private companies. So they're trying to dig out trees that have value. And the loggers didn't like that we were using the road through the logging areas, which are public land, to get to the 7,000, 8,000 acres that are private land, which, by the way, they have right of access to. So we think the loggers maybe took the boards.
Yeah.
Suck, obviously, because they were already cutting down trees. So it's like, why would you cut? Mind you, they were cut at the perfect width to make like a bar or a countertop, and they were 20 feet long, and somebody already did it. Great. But we built that road over a creek, and that's like one of the micro crappy things we dealt with, I guess, the first time out. But it's a lot easier to go to the ruins that we're working on. They're off a paved road and they're still in the jungle, but you can walk out of the jungle into a village.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Even if you're hundreds, you know, if you're out of a few hundred acres, if you're a few acres in, it's like not much of a walk compared to 7,000 acres. Because then the property itself had a road. They put a road on it. The owner did, which would grow over with weeds and things. But it was about, there was a rectangle loop within his property, and it was about 5 miles of road in a rectangle.
Man. And once again, the just the idea of 4,000 acres. That is an expanse of land, you know.
Oh, for the scanning, for Christie's LiDAR scan?
Yeah.
For what we're going to do? Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been a lot. We didn't get to scan it, but...
Well, not by hand or anything. Were you able to scan it from air?
No, that's what... No? We got to scan it by hand. We weren't able to scan the 4,000 by air. Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
No, we could.
What are some of the things, at least from what you've found thus far and local history, things like that? So what are some of the things that you were expecting to find on the local property?
Oh.
Can we share it?
We could say anything. Go for it.
Okay. Well, I think that there's still a ton of artifacts in the ground that haven't been uncovered.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty obvious given what we've uncovered so far that as soon as we start busting up the soil, it's going to show us things. So there have been stones like jade recovered from. So all around this is farmland. All around the ruins is just farmland. Farmers all the time are just out doing, you know, farming. And you know what I mean? And
I do.
And they just will pull up stones from the earth.
Yeah.
And these are really high valued. So they just
like jade and obsidian.
Oh, sure.
Crystal.
And they just, yeah. And they show us these things when we're down there and where our mind is just blown. They don't really understand what they're holding, but
well, some of them do. They get up, you know, yeah. I think it's better. Yeah, they don't
understand. They might understand, but they don't have any idea of how to make money on it or to do with it. Find it. They don't know how to.
I think their system of value for it is different than ours. It'd be no different than if a Native American was plowing up his field and ran across a tomahawk head.
Right.
You know, we would value that in a different way, not just monetarily, but in how we value that intrinsically. Sure. They see that in a much different way that yes, is not necessarily about money. Right, whereas we would find a jade artifact and be like, oh my God, you know, like straight Indiana Jones, like this belongs in a museum. And they're like, yeah, man, it just keeps tearing up my plow though.
Exactly.
Like you realize how much my plow costs, right?
Yeah.
I need that to live. I don't need the little pieces of jade trinkets that are in the ground tearing up my plowhead.
Right.
You know? And it's interesting even for you to point that out, Christy, the fact of they find these things in the ground all the time, but to them they're just something that's in the ground and was left. You know, it's not anything of any intrinsic let's build a museum on the corner of the property value.
Yeah, I think typically when they see things like that, they just think, how much money can I get from it? Because I don't think they're really that concerned with, you know, creating a museum holding on to it.
The historic significance of it.
The discovery and learning and
And
connecting the pieces, but more or less, this is going to help me feed my family.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They're subsistence farming. They are only farming by hand. Mm-hmm. 2-3 acres max. And this is an all day, every day. They can do 2 or 3 crops a year.
Yeah.
And this feeds them. They have nothing. So they lose a crop. It's everything. And if you find a jade crystal jeweled stone artifact, that is that the value that mm-hmm. that's a lifetime income for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That can put their kids through even elementary to high school. That's all you have to pay. It's not free. They have no free education.
Yeah.
So many of the students, they'll make it, the girls in particular, they'll make it only so many years, and the boys might go longer, but then there's no trade schools. There's, you know, we met someone wonderful who's trying to build a trade school in Belize right now. But there isn't too many opportunities beyond what you see here in the picture with Christy.
Yeah.
They go as long as they can, but the farmers all pay for each of their kids and their uniforms and their meals. And then they have to then graduate. And in the picture where you're sitting, see them sitting in the house or sitting by in front of the house along the bench, they're all just, that's pretty much it. That's your day when you're not in school. There's either working with the family on the farm or in the house with mom. There isn't any real downtime there. And so the value of an artifact, the value of a crystal that they can, if they had a museum, they could make money on tickets and tours. If they had it in a museum, they could trade it. You know, museums trade with each other. There's a whole system. There's a whole way for them to make money as a community that they're not entirely aware of. So I think Christy's right, though. I think our year is traveling and investigating and videoing and documenting what we're doing. We're going back to Belize, obviously, if you want to come on that expedition on rqx.com, but it's not going to be this year for as much as the logistical planning to get ground penetrating radar, to get the approvals from NICHE, to get the whatever archaeologists we're going to have attached to our program.
Yeah.
We're going to have to figure all that out. And then there's an investment portion to it. And in order for the documentarian entertainment side of it, we are going around right now, actively looking and pursuing someone to back that very kind of entertainment and an expedition and education.
So the ultimate goal of ArchaeoX is really just to connect all the pieces of this experience. You know, I mean, ultimately, what we're doing when we're looking beneath the surface, when we're uncovering these ruins, is for what's the word I'm looking for? Connection. It's just funny.
Yeah.
All my alternative answers.
I'm just going to sum it up. Is that what you were funny?
No.
Is that why?
No, because you're like, what's the word I'm looking for? And I was just thinking of like all the dumb crap I could have said. I filter a lot of stupid stuff out, everyone. And
So the ultimate goal of ArchaeoX is really just to connect all of the pieces. We have this globe, this planet that we live on. We're all disconnected. We're disconnected consciously. We're disconnected physically. We're supposed to live in community with one another and the planet. And we're not doing that. We're not living that way. And so there's a broader connection that we're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, a conscious connection between the things that we're uncovering, you know, the civilizations that preceded us, and trying to figure out, you know, we know that time isn't linear. And so you take the idea of of, I don't know, a religious heaven and hell or a spiritual multidimensional universe that we possibly live in. And, you know, we're trying to, and the more we uncover, the more we discover, the more connections we're able to make between these ancient sites across the globe, the more sense we're able to make of this human experience, because what we've been told and taught, you know, the way we've been programmed and conditioned through, you know, traditional education systems, you know, the history books are written by the victors. You know, the dead people aren't writing the stories.
Yeah.
The people that live are writing the stories. And so it's skewed and it's biased. And so what we're trying to do is uncover truths, you know, the truth about where we came from, the truth about why we don't remember. You know, and some of us do. Some of us have, you know, we do past life regressions, or we have, you know, through hypnosis or ways that we can recall memories, whether that's genetic memory or ancestral memory, you know, whatever it is. But there's people that can recall, like, you know, kids having spiritual experiences when they're young and being able to see things that, you know, and feel and experience and sense things that we as adults have forgotten how to do, you know, because I think we're born more sensitive than we end up as adults, you know, because we're born and then we're programmed into whatever society or culture, tradition, you know, religious belief system, political, whatever, you know, you're born into. And then that's what you believe, you know, and then it's not until maybe we get older that we have the bandwidth, you know, as a mother of three. You know, I've always questioned, but it took me a little while to have just the bandwidth to actually sit around and contemplate my existence.
Well, and you know, that is something that we discuss regularly on the show and that we were discussing tonight. You know, the idea of we have lost a lot of connection with the world around us. At one point, you had to have an intimate knowledge of the night sky to live. To know when to put plants down, you know, to know when to reap your crop, to know when to move with the food you're hunting, things like that. And even to circle this right back to the beginning of our conversation, the idea of bringing this cultural history back to the people of the localized area, because once again, it's not that someone in the village, a grandmother or someone like that, doesn't remember some of the stories that have been passed down. But when you're a subsistence farmer, it's pretty rare that you have the time to go explore that back 40, you know, to just go explore it and to just go look around. You're oddly enough, you're busy actively living.
Right. You know? Don't have the bandwidth to think about what's, you know, like, let's go buy a metal detector. Or let's go dig around in the dirt in the backyard. You're too busy trying. It's like Maslow's hierarchy.
Absolutely.
You know, you're too busy meeting the bottom rung before you can move on to the next one. And if you can't satisfy all your basic human needs, food, shelter, water, you know, you can't move up to the next. And so these people aren't back there. They're not down there thinking about what's beneath the surface. You know, they're just trying to like eat and not be hungry.
Yes. Yes, precisely.
And, you know, just recently, what was it in the fall? The wildfires blew through. Well, they were sort of wildfires.
They
blew through Belize and, you know, some of the community was damaged because of that. And, you know, when that's a devastating thing for these people in these villages, when things like that happen, it's devastating. Their crops are burned, so they don't have food. Their shelter is gone. You know, they don't have shelter. And so they go from barely surviving to how are we going to literally survive the week?
Yeah.
You know? So it's a big deal. Like all the help, all the aid that we can provide, all the ways that we can teach them and help them, you know, whether it's through tourism or, you know, providing jobs of any sort. We've talked about, you know, developing some real estate down there and building cabanas on the river.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a way for them to bring in money. They would operate, you know, they would manage, it would open up so many doors and create so many jobs.
Well, and once again, the idea even of archaeotourism, things like that, help to do the same thing. They using localized guides, that kind of stuff. It's a fantastic opportunity for the local community. And the fact that I have lauded you since our first conversations about this, like I said, a couple years ago, almost, Jared, the idea that you have connected with the local mayor, with the local government, and have been making these inroads and making those relationships and making this happen and garnering even their interest to this point. Because once again, it can be very hard for local communities to want to adopt such a thing. You know,
hugely. They were not all in agreement.
And it was the third meeting. So it was when I was down there on this one.
Yeah.
We went to a town hall, a city meeting or a village meeting or whatever. And the elders in there started speaking Mayan.
Oh, yeah.
And we were just sitting in the, and it got heated.
Oh,
and we were just sitting there like, oh. What's happening?
They were not happy. Part of our group is watching, and I'm up in front with Alfredo, and I'm sitting there taking the heat at the front, but they're busy yelling at each other in Mayan. I mean, they just quit with the English when they wanted to get down to it. They were, they were at it. They were at each other.
They were not happy with one another.
And like I said, communities either embrace this or they shun it. One of the two. And it can be very hard to find a middle ground with such things. So just the fact that you have developed this to the point that you've developed it, that you have even gotten the uncovering done to the point that you've done it is a fantastic victory. And it's absolutely amazing. And
I have to think about that. No one does that.
You did that.
Yeah.
You were there too.
It's fantastic to see what you have done so far, and I cannot wait to see what comes of it in the future, guys. It's absolutely awesome. We have you for about another 3-4 minutes in that time. Let's promote the trip a little bit. Tell us a little bit about the archaeo exploration opportunities there in Belize and how people can get involved with ArchaeoX, things like that.
Oh, please come to the website. Look at our May 2025 trip. I'm going to pre-sell everyone on this before I let Christy say a word and say that we have underpriced this.
Hugely.
So it's an incredible deal. And really, between the Mayan ruins and the caves and the activities that we have planned with the accommodations, the tour, the transportation, everything, right? You have to get down there. But for 10 days and 9 nights, what we have planned is pretty spectacular and an incredible deal. And the next time we do this, it's going to be like $2,000 more. So that's how good the service is.
That's true.
So you're getting like a $5,800, $6,000 trip for way too cheap. So please come.
It is absolutely an incredible opportunity to see an amazing, amazing facility down there. And once again, what you guys have done archaeologically just to begin with is great. It's really fantastic.
Well, it is. Thank you. But Christy, do you want to say something serious about that trip?
So we're going to visit multiple Mayan sites, including the ArchaeoX working site. We're also going to do a cave tour, which is an amazing system that you step into and you feel like you're in some sort of underground cathedral. It's amazing. And what's really interesting is it's not open to the public.
Oh,
so
great.
Unless you go with us, you can't go. You can't find it because you have to know people in the village who know where the cave's at to make it to the cave. So it's not a site that's visited. It's not a cave tour that's roped off. It's actually like an adventure cave.
And by adventure cave, it's massive. It's basically a hollowed out mountain.
Mm-hmm. The top, the ceilings on the inside reach 80 foot. So it's 80 foot ceilings on the inside. It's massive.
That is huge. That is an amazing opportunity, especially just the fact of it's not roped off in any kind of way like that. That's awesome because it's pretty rare that unless you're a spelunker or something like that, that you would even find such an opportunity.
So right.
That's wicked cool.
Yeah. And then we'll have yoga, daily yoga and breathwork opportunities. Yeah. And some of the breathwork opportunities will be on the ruined sites, which is really interesting because the last trip down there, I was able to meditate on each of the sites we went to, and it is different. It's a different experience. It's like when when I was in Peru and Pisac and the Sacred Valley, they call it that for a reason. And you can feel the spiritual energy. It's just different. So that'll be available also.
Yeah, there's going to be, it really is.
It's going to be an amazing trip.
We are certainly planning. We have it on the website. If you see Peru and Egypt, that is in the works. We are planning each of those trips. We're going to have more information about those, but really the best thing to do right now would be to join us. The evening plans, the ruins, the sites, the breath work, everything we have planned throughout the day is really amazing, but we do expect to have some really great conversations with everyone who comes, and the evenings are also going to be quite entertaining and fun.
Well, fantastic, guys. I am excited for y'all. I am excited for anybody that gets a chance to go on this because, once again, to be able to see sites in progress is something that you do not often get to see. So to see something before it truly becomes, and once again, the idea of even 40 acres being uncovered is still massive. That is a huge amount of space. So congratulations on everything as always, guys. Thank you so much for your time tonight. It's been great. Before we let you go, one last time, let everybody know what that website is, where they can go to join.
That's rkeox.com.
All right. Fantastic. Please do hold the line real quick while I close things out with the audience. While you are online, reserving your spot on the upcoming Belizean expedition with rkeox.com at rkeox.com. Everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find the store full of books, movies, classes, all kinds of things from our guests, as well as the official Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFOs, UAPs, cryptozoology, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your back pocket data log to write down all of your data in the field as it happens so that you are ready to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. Remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.